Reaching Out for the Blind here on ACB Radio, where you're listening is our business. I'm Brian McKellen. Before we get into today's show, here's some exciting news for all ACB Radio listeners. You now can listen to this and other ACB Radio programs anytime on a telephone. Just dial 231-460-1047 and follow the instructions to listen to any ACB radio station. It's easy, and most of all, allows you to listen to our show from anywhere there is a phone connection. I also have another announcement to make. There's going to be a free yoga class for the blind and visually impaired on Thursday, May 15th from 6 to 7 p.m. at the Asian Art Museum on 200 Larkin Street in San Francisco. It'll be in the Samsung Room, and there will also be a free audio tour from 7 to 7:45 immediately following the yoga class. It's in honor of the current and fabulous exhibit at the museum called Yoga, the Art of Transformation. The Asian Art Museum is easily accessible from the Civic Center BART station. Everyone who is interested must contact the yoga instructor, Nancy Yates. So everybody who is interested in attending the event must contact Nancy Yates at nancyyates1@gmail.com. That's uppercase N, A-N-C-Y, Y-A-T-E-S, @gmail.com. You may also call Nancy at 415-346-8119. Anybody can leave a message, and she'll return your call quickly. Now back to today, Speaking Out for the Blind show. According to CTV News, one very scary thing happened to Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield. Chris went blind during a spacewalk. His left eye slammed shut, and he felt great pain. And Chris couldn't figure out why his eye wasn't working. Chris then asked himself, "What do I do now?" By looking at the differences between perceived and actual danger, Chris overcame his fear and worked through the problem despite being blind outside of a spaceship. Then Chris got his vision back. Chris joins us today to tell us the story of being blind in space. Hi, Chris.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm good. So let's first learn how you became an astronaut. Why did you become an astronaut? And give us an example of when you had to advocate for yourself in learning how to do this special job and ultimately being chosen for space missions.
Well, it's like a lot of things. It's a very long road from the ease of an initial dream and decision through to the reality of trying to make it happen. But I first decided to be an astronaut as a kid when I was 9 years old, being inspired by some of the first people to travel to space, specifically the first moonwalkers, and then pursued that path as an ultimate dream with never any real guarantee that anything was going to happen, but pursued an education of engineering and flying and diving and becoming a pilot and a test pilot, and then eventually getting chosen as an astronaut, and then, of course, working for 21 years as an astronaut before and flying in space 3 times. But I don't know if advocate for myself is the right word. It's more turn myself into who I wanted to be. It's more like a sculpting or a whittling process of a slow transformation of trying to take who I was when I first thought of it and turn myself into someone who I thought might be selectable and capable of flying in space.
This is Speaking Out for the Blind, so we just wanted to learn a little bit about how you spoke out, too, along with your time as being an astronaut. You mentioned, I heard in your TED Talk, you mentioned dealing with fear. In your work as an astronaut, did anybody ever think that you can deal with fear? And how did you, or did you have to speak up to prove these people wrong?
The fundamental core of most of the things I've done in my adult life have been competency-based. I was a fighter pilot, and that is very much rigorous skill and self-discipline. And then even more so after that, a test pilot, where what you're doing is has an elevated level of danger. I lost one good friend a year for the entire time that I was a professional military pilot. So it's definitely a dangerous thing. And so therefore, you have to know the difference between danger and fear. And it's not a matter of people, they didn't think I could deal with fear. Instead, it becomes a cultural thing of how do you set yourself up in an inherently dangerous profession and then find ways to succeed and find ways to not only not be limited by fear, but also how do you overcome the danger or understand it well enough that you don't put yourself in a situation that is near fatal or fatal. And so it's not so much other people putting external definitions of fear or concerns about me. It was much more an internal evolutionary struggle of learning how to deal with things that should be inherently scary. Probably the best example, Brian, is when I went through test pilot school, one of the things you need to learn is how to take care of an airplane that's out of control, that is tumbling and spinning or in a flat spin or in a full tumble. And when you first do it, it's quite daunting and fear-inducing to put an airplane out of control. But after you've done it several times, you not only become more comfortable at it, but you can actually recognize what's happening while it's going on. You can talk about it. You can say, okay, the nose is up, the nose is down. Okay, we've got a significant left row. We've got a high right yaw rate. And you can become analytical and almost dispassionate in what should be a wildly fear-generating situation. And that process is one that then applies to your whole life, not just to flying airplanes. But once you've managed to figure out that there's a way to keep fear from dominating your life and therefore your actions, or your actions and therefore your life, that it doesn't just have to stick at work, but it applies to everything.
So how can we really conquer our fears and not let them limit life's possibilities?
I think the real key, and you mentioned the TED Talk, is what I've been thinking about, and it's one I put in my book as well, The Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, is how do you separate fear and danger? Because danger is a measurable thing. Fear is a human reaction to it. Things aren't fearful. People's reactions are fearful. And everyone does dangerous things. You just don't think about it. You know, driving a car, you know that I think last year in the U.S., 35,000 people were killed driving cars, and a lot more were injured. Or just being a passenger in a car, or crossing the street, or using a vending machine. You know, there are things that kill people every year. And for whatever reason, either because you just don't understand it or you don't think about it, you don't get fearful. And yet other things, like having a bug land on you, can cause this great panicky, fearful reaction when the chances of a bug landing on you actually doing you any serious harm is extremely small. And the key is then, what are the actual dangers, the real true dangers, and what are your fearful reactions to things? And are you hampering yourself by mismatching the two? And if you can think about it, if you can look at it and go, oh, you know what, that thing that I've been so afraid of, whether it's, you know, you can choose your example, buying a piece of property learning to drive a car in the snow or getting married or something, some commitment or something that takes a risk. Now, what are the actual dangers involved? And what are my fearful worries about it? And let's try not to let my fear keep me from doing things in life that otherwise I would never have a chance to sample and see it and work on it one by one. And then, of course, the only way you can really work on it is to identify the true danger, understand it, and then practice dealing with that danger under safe circumstances. Practice it over and over again. If it's public speaking or whatever, if it's having a car go out of control, you know, go to a parking lot where you can't run into anything and do it 100 times or whatever. If it's falling when you're skating or something. Give yourself a permissive set of circumstances to practice whatever it is over and over and over again, so that then when the real situation comes up, it won't be your instinctive fearful reaction that drives you to do what you would do. Instead, you can have a new learned response. And that could open up great opportunities in life if you just allow yourself to go through the process.
You gave that TED Talk. It's the Technology, Entertainment, and Design presentation given by many, many noted people. You gave one in Vancouver, British Columbia. You explained how you went on your mission aboard Space Shuttle Discovery and departed from the Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral, Florida. Give our audience some background on that mission.
It was the first assembly flight to go help build the Russian space station Mir. And I'd been, of course, trying to be an astronaut my whole life. This was my first time. And so it's a pretty amazing thing to get into a space shuttle in Florida, as you mentioned, and launch. And the risks during launch, at the time, the shuttle was still not even halfway through its life. And we thought we understood it well, but boy, we sure didn't. The actual risk of death during launch was only like 1 in 35 or something like that. Terrible odds, you know. And we thought it was much safer than that. But, you know, you learn as you go. And the space shuttle was a brand new technology that was difficult to predict exactly the problems that it would run into. And so we learned everything we could, and we managed the technology as well as we could. And on that flight, we were very successful going up to go build the space station Mir. And the process of learning to speak some Russian then, and training in Russia, and forging the bond between the Russian Space Agency and NASA and other international partners, all of those things were really critical to the success that we have now on the International Space Station.
While you did the spacewalk, you went completely blind, but you just kept going and going like the Energizer Bunny on your mission. Did anybody ever think, because you couldn't see space, that you couldn't complete the mission?
Sure. It was not what I expected to happen during my first spacewalk, of course. And it was inexplicable at the time. It's as if suddenly one of your hands was paralyzed and you're trying to figure out what the heck just happened to my left hand. And say you were, I don't know, you're doing something relatively complex with your hands. You're pushing a lawnmower or turning a wrench, fixing something, or working on a plumbing problem or whatever. And suddenly one of your hands stops working, or in this case, one of my eyes stopped working. It was painful. I couldn't figure out what the cause was, but at the same time, I went, well, shoot, I've got another eye, just like you could say I have another hand. And probably my hand isn't, or my eye isn't gone for good, so I'll just keep on working. Maybe like a spasm or a cramp. But unfortunately, in weightlessness, if you get something that is contaminating and hurting your eye, your eye's natural reaction, of course, is to tear up. And unfortunately, in weightlessness, tears don't fall, and so the natural flushing action doesn't occur. And instead of my eye clearing itself of the problem that was causing it to not work, it just got a larger and larger contaminated ball of stuff on it until, inevitably, in weightlessness, that contamination got big enough to flow across the bridge of my nose into my other eye and blind my other eye. And so I immediately called down to Houston and said, you know, Houston, I have a problem or whatever. And they, of course, were quite concerned that we wouldn't be able to complete the spacewalk. And without the spacewalk, we were building something outside that was going to be threatening the whole mission. But we treated it like we treat everything else. Let's have a look at the real danger here. And the real danger isn't all that big. So your eyes aren't working. breathing, and you can still hear, and you can still talk, and you can still think, and there's something, you're not out there alone, there's one other person out there with you. And so even though it was a significant change in sense, it wasn't debilitating, and it was something we discussed, and we really wanted to see if it was going to stop us finishing the tasks and whether it was going to be permanent or just relatively temporary. And so we worked the problem for quite a while, but it was definitely a serious concern that going blind, if it had been something that was permanent or semi-permanent for my vision, then it was going to have a real impact of not being able to complete the mission. So, yeah, we treated it very seriously at first.
Did you have to speak up on behalf to show the astronauts, your fellow astronauts, that you could overcome this brief blindness and continue on with the mission? And did you do the same thing with mission control?
Yeah, that's the real key question. And of course, when you say my fellow astronauts and my crewmates, mission control is in that category. We're all in it together. Although I was the only one blind that day. But yes, everyone has to take my word for it as to how debilitating it was for me, how much I was still able to function, whether it was, you know, terrifying me or just something I was dealing with. And then also whether it was getting better or not, whether, you know, my vision was clearing or at least my ability to function was changing to adapt. And I worked it and talked to them, and we worked a couple possibilities with the suit that we were thinking maybe if we opened the valve on the suit and let it hiss out to space for a while, that would clear contamination from inside the suit. So we did that for a while. But eventually it was just my body's natural tearing, flushing mechanism. I teared up enough that it eventually diluted the contamination so I could start just to see light and dark again. And as far as me convincing everyone, yeah, I definitely had to, number one, convince people that I was calm and okay and that I wasn't floating away or something. And then, two, as soon as I could start to see any improvement at all, then I was, of course, immediately announcing that to the world of, okay, this is still no good, but it's getting better, and I think we're going to be okay, and let's hang on here, and I think I'll be able to at least see partially here shortly. So, yeah, I was very much my own advocate to try and make the situation have as little impact as possible on what everybody was worried about.
Scott was one of your fellow astronauts, and he helped you continue the spacewalk blind. How did you convince Scott to go forward with you and complete that mission?
During a spacewalk, sometimes the two of you are linked. It takes four hands or maybe one person to see and the other person to reach or something, because the suits are very, very clumsy. But often you're working separately from each other. The two of you are doing individual tasks, like two rock climbers or two car mechanics or something. And so I just mostly had to tell Scott, okay, keep doing what you're doing. I don't need your help right now. You don't need to come and rescue me. I'm not in dire straits. I just can't see. And keep working at what you're doing. And if it gets worse, then I'll call you over. But then also reprioritizing, saying, okay, this is going to take a while to clear. So, Scott, why don't you pick up this task and that task, and you go get that done, because I'm not going to be able to see well enough to do these for a while. And that worked out just fine. And Scott and I had trained together for years and knew each other, so it was a constant running mutual conversation of how to deal with a change of circumstances but still keep the actual objectives in mind.
Scott, he led you back into the shuttle, and he wiped that crusty stuff called antifog out of your eye. It was crusty stuff called antifog. What was this sort of antifog?
On the visor of the spacewalking suit, which is a big sheet of quite hard plastic, we're concerned while we're working inside the suit that our breath will fog it up and make a mist on it, especially because it's a closed suit, and sometimes you can be working really hard, and your breath will put, like fogging up a mirror, you'll have to put a mist onto it. And you can put coatings on glass, of course, to keep it from, or to decrease the chances that it'll fog. And so before I'd gone out on the spacewalk, I had taken a little bit of this anti-fog, which was a mixture of oil and soap, put it on the visor, and then polished it, rubbed it with a dry cloth. But I hadn't, I guess, polished it well enough. And then during the spacewalk, there was a little bit of loose water floating around in weightlessness inside the helmet. And it was really just one of these drops of water that was actually leaking from my drink bag that floated, picked up some of the anti-fog off of the visor, and then somehow floated over and got into my eye. So it was the equivalent of squirting soap and oil into the tenderness of your eye. So it wasn't something that was permanent, but boy, it sure caused, like if you put soap and oil into, I don't know, into a wound or something, you know, it just hurts. And it kept my eyes from working for a while. But afterwards, the crew used some Q-tips and bags and things to collect the crusty stuff so that the doctors and technicians could look on the ground. And that's how we knew for sure that it was anti-fog when it was analyzed later on the ground.
How did you speak out and gain the crew's confidence that you could successfully guide the space shuttle back home?
Oh, well, there was time to recover. You know, my eyes, they stung for several days, like any part of your body that gets injured. But they worked well enough, and we decided it was a transient. Almost more importantly, I had to convince everybody that I could go outside on another spacewalk 2 days later. You know, same suit, same risk, but... We thought we understood the problem well enough to realize that it wasn't a debilitating or extremely high-risk thing to happen again. We considered it a one-time event. And so it was more a matter of proving competence, of showing that we understood the problem, separating the fear from the danger, proving that we were able to deal with it in the future, and then carrying on to try and get something done. And everyone was quite good about it, of course.
You mentioned you have a new book out. Tell me about that book and where our listeners can get it, how much it costs.
Yeah, I wrote a book called An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, because that's where things really matter, you know. And like any exaggerated thing, you know, often if you want to understand a problem, if you can exaggerate it somehow, if you can use an electron microscope to analyze it, or an oscilloscope or a telescope or something, you can see something or sense something that you wouldn't understand otherwise. And the life of an astronaut tends to be sort of that exaggerated life, to do the bizarre things and the risky things that we do. And those things that you learn, the behaviors and such that you learn, maybe they're useful to everyone. And a lot of an astronaut's life isn't in space, it's on Earth. So the purpose of the book was exactly what the title says, and that is A Guide to Life on Earth. And it's been extremely well received. It was a New York Times bestseller, an LA Times. It's already, I think, in 14 languages now, and it's only been out for 5 or 6 months. So I've been very happy that people have been finding the book useful. And I have a printed version of it, like you hold in the hands kind of book, and it's available electronically. And then last August, I spent 4 days making an audio version of the book also. Which was a fun exercise to read your own book aloud and try and bring it to life using your own voice. And all of those versions, you know, depending what people want the most or is most suited to them, are available. You could get it all sorts of places. I think it's most readily available to a lot of folks through Amazon or somewhere, and in countries all around the world. But I think... of course, if folks are blind, the audio version will be perfect, and I think you can order it through Amazon. I'm not sure how much it costs. It's on the order of $20, I think, or $15. So hopefully someone will find it worth the money to have a little more insight into the type of things that not only that astronauts do, but how they manage to do them, and whether there's something that is useful out of all that. Chance to talk about it with you.
And Chris, we wish you very much continued success in life. You're truly an inspiration to those who want to overcome their fears of being blind. Thanks so much for joining us on the show today.
Well, thanks very much, Brian. I appreciate it. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
Let me give listeners a quick reminder. I welcome comments and suggestions on today's episode or past and future shows. Just visit and like me on Facebook at Speaking Out for the Blind, or follow me on Twitter at Speak Out Blind. That's all for this edition of Speaking Out for the Blind. Thanks for listening. And remember to speak out.